Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on June 26, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Telephone Practice Group conference call on Arizona versus U.S., the U.S. Supreme Court case decided just yesterday. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we have two experts to help sort out the court's ruling, Dr. John Eastman and Professor Margaret Stock. Each will speak for about 5 to 8 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. Dr. John Eastman is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law, where he also served as the school's dean. He served as a clerk with Justice Clarence Thomas at the Supreme Court and with Judge Michael Luttig on the Fourth Circuit. Professor Margaret Stock is a nationally known expert on immigration and national security laws and has testified regularly before congressional committees on immigration, homeland security, and military matters. She's also served as a professor at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and she currently serves as an adjunct instructor at the University of Alaska. And with that, Professor Eastman, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
So the court's decision yesterday resolves some preliminary matters in the legal challenges to Arizona's SB 1070. It's important for people to understand what was at issue before the court and what remains to be resolved. The Department of Justice had challenged the entirety of SB 1070, sought a preliminary injunction to prevent it from going into effect. The lower courts, both the District Court and the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, allowed most of the provisions of the statute to go into effect and enjoined preliminarily four provisions. And those were the four provisions that were at issue before the Supreme Court. Section 2B, which is the so-called check your papers provision that authorizes or even mandates that local law enforcement in Arizona, whenever they have lawfully detained or stopped somebody, ascertain their immigration status when they have reasonable suspicion, not based on race or ethnic background, but other reasonable suspicion to think they may be here in the country illegally. Section 3 created a state law crime for failure to carry the immigration papers that are required by federal law. The penalties under Section 3 paralleled the penalties for the federal crime. Section 5C made it a state law crime to seek work in violation of federal law, but the federal statutory scheme only provides criminal sanctions on the employers. Only civil sanctions are available for employees. And Section 6 authorized Arizona law enforcement to make warrantless arrests whenever they had a probable cause to believe that an illegal immigrant had committed an act that rendered them removable under the federal immigration laws. The Supreme Court looked at those four decisions and unanimously, by an 8-0 vote, reversed the injunction of Section 2B, or in other words, upheld Section 2B that authorizes or mandates local law enforcement to check the status of immigrants when they are otherwise lawfully stopped. It did, however, affirm the injunction against the other three provisions, Section 3, Section 5C, and Section 6, contending that those provisions were all impliedly preempted by the federal statutory scheme, either by field preemption, which is the doctrine that says Congress has so comprehensively occupied the field in a particular area as to leave no room for state action in the area, or what's called obstacle preemption, that somehow the state's enforcement, though not in direct conflict, stand as an obstacle to the enforcement of the federal immigration policies. So that's kind of the description of what happened. Now, the majority decision on Section 2B, the 8-0 decision, does raise a lot of red flags about how that might be implemented and suggests that there may be ways that it could be implemented constitutionally, but also ways that it may be implemented unconstitutionally. For example, if it turns out in practice that there's no way to implement Section 2B without racial profiling or ethnic background profiling, Justice Kennedy seems to suggest that that would clearly be unconstitutional. Or if there's no way to implement it without imposing additional detention on the person who is reasonably suspected of being in the country illegally while that investigation is occurring, the delay in detention might also create constitutional problems. But the court unanimously deferred to the state of Arizona and to the state courts to work out whether that provision can be interpreted and implemented in a way that meets constitutional muster. The other three provisions, though, are the ones that split either 6-2 or 5-3, and there are only 8 votes here because Justice Elena Kagan was recused from the case. She was Solicitor General of the United States when those litigations were begun and therefore was involved in the case and needed to recuse herself. I'll leave it for another day whether the same exact rule ought to have applied in the healthcare challenge, which will be coming down on Thursday. But these other provisions, which created the split on the court, either 6-2 or 5-3, turned on the court's assessment of these implied preemption doctrines, and they're fairly complicated. And increasingly, the court has trended away from implied preemption doctrines, either field preemption or obstacle preemption, recognizing, and I think quite rightly, that ascertaining either one of those requires an interpretive methodology by the court into Congress's unspoken intent that it's always a dangerous thing. Justice Kennedy's opinion, lead opinion for the court on those issues, though, bucks that trend and it fully embraces the old both field preemption and obstacle preemption doctrines in order to strike down Arizona statutes. And that drew both a pretty strong dissent from Justice Alito and from Justice Thomas and a broad-based dissent about the nature of state sovereignty from Justice Scalia. And I think those are the issues that are the most interesting. But for the not faint of heart, you've got to be a real constitutional geek and deep embedded into the preemption doctrine and its nuances to fully appreciate what was going on in those aspects of the case. So end of the day, though, what does it mean for Arizona and the enforcement of its immigration law? Many of the provisions. Like I said, of the law were not preliminary enjoined. They were not before the court. They went into effect back when the law was passed in 2010 and remain in effect. And some of those are rather significant. The states can, for example, have a state law crime, arrest people if they stop and pick up migrant workers, day laborers, if doing so impedes traffic. They can make it a state law crime to transport or harbor illegal immigrants. They can impound cars that are used for the transportation of illegal immigrants. A number of tools in addition to Section 2B that appear to be authorized, and both Arizona and a number of the states have been waiting in the wings with their own bills to see what the Supreme Court was going to do here, may have some, though not all, of the tools that were available to them before yesterday to try and address the consequences of illegal immigration within their states. And those consequences are rather dramatic. Justice Kennedy, in his opinion, points out several of them. For example, in Arizona, for example, almost 6% of the population is unauthorized or illegally present in the state. It points to a study that in Arizona's most populous county, they were responsible for a disproportionate amount of serious crime. Unauthorized aliens in Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix, compromised just under 9% of the population, but were responsible for almost 22% of the felonies in the county. Justice Kennedy describes this as an epidemic of crime, safety risks, serious property damage, and environmental problems associated with the influx of illegal immigration across the Mexican border. These things are serious, and one of the things we're going to have to look at going forward is you know, how effective can the states be in trying to police the internal effects of illegal immigration within their borders and still stay on the constitutional side of the line that the courts have now drawn? And with that, I'll pass it over to Margaret.
Thank you very much, John. I agree with everything you've said. I do think, in fact, that Arizona has faced a very serious problem and that it passed SB 1070 in an attempt to deal with that problem. Unfortunately, the court has now, the Supreme Court of the United States has now given a resounding no to state attempts to do any kind of serious state regulation of immigration. And although John's correct that there's plenty of the law that wasn't at issue in this case that still can go forward, the court, in fact, has created a pretty grave setback to those who would attempt to give teeth to state immigration regulation, basically saying that this is a matter of federal law. It's true that the system is a mess and that the federal government hasn't done what it's supposed to do, but it's really up to Congress to be regulating immigration and not to the states. So this decision is going to have a wide-ranging effect on the states that have similar laws, the copycat states, they call them. Their laws presumably will no longer be constitutional if they're similar to Arizona's. It's also very, very important to point out that, as John said correctly, this is up at the Supreme Court on a preliminary injunction against four provisions of the law. And the preliminary injunction has now been upheld against three of those sections, and they're the three sections that actually had teeth. The one section on which the court was unanimous and sent back down, they didn't quite uphold it. What they said was it's not facially unconstitutional, and so we're going to send it back to the lower court, and now the lower court can consider challenges to the law as applied. So the fight is going to continue here. It's not the end of the case. It just means that challenges to how the law is applied can now go forward. Or in other words, Arizona can now try to apply the part of the law that is possibly constitutional. As John mentioned, if Arizona does so in an unconstitutional manner, the law could be enjoined again. So the fight is now going to shift back to the lower federal court. And that is where the problem is going to occur, because in the Supreme Court's majority opinion, they said that Arizona could enforce Section 2B. And again, Section 2B is the part of SB 1070 that says, for any lawful stop, detention, or arrest made by a law enforcement official in the enforcement of any other law or ordinance where reasonable suspicion exists that the person is an alien and is unlawfully present in the United States, a reasonable attempt shall be made when practicable to determine the immigration status of the person. That's the law that they said Arizona can now attempt to enforce. But, of course, the problem here is going to be that couple of things. First, this is the only provision of the law that doesn't actually have any teeth. It doesn't really have any teeth. It's not a criminal provision. It just says you can check somebody's status. And of course, the states had already been doing that, but the courts now laid out some specific guidelines for how to carry out this part of the law, and it's going to be very difficult for law enforcement to follow those guidelines. They're going to need very, very careful training. The prior training that Arizona law enforcement got on this particular law, SB 1070, now has to be thrown out and revised. Arizona is going to have to retrain all its police officers. And basically what they're going to have to do is say to the law enforcement, you can check people's immigration status if you lawfully stop them, detain them, arrest them. But you have to be really careful not to violate the provision of the law about racial profiling. You have to be careful not to detain anyone as the result of a check. You can detain them for another offense, but not because of an immigration check. You have to be careful not to fail to release anyone pending a check. If you detain them longer than necessary for the purpose that you originally stopped them for, that can create a constitutional rights violation. You have to be very careful not to apply this law in some manner that's going to cause people to argue that you're applying it differently to people from one place rather than another. So It's a bit of a no-win for Arizona. They're going to have to be very, very careful, according to the Supreme Court's majority opinion, in the way that they apply the law now. And then the problem becomes if they do find out the person's not authorized, they do the check, what do they do now? If they hold the person and the government, federal government doesn't come and get them, they've got a problem. They could try to charge them with some other state crime, but the state crimes that were listed in SB 1070 that they could have charged them with have now been tossed out as unconstitutional. If they make a mistake they're going to get sued, and federal law allows them to get sued, Title 28, United States Code, Section 1983. And then, of course, people can get attorney's fees under Section 1988. If they make too many mistakes when they're stopping people under this provision, the rest of the statute will get enjoined as unconstitutional, as enforced. So it's not exactly a win for Arizona. It's going to be a significant administrative challenge for them to go forward with just this part of the law and do so in a manner that is constitutional. Interestingly, the reason this is happening and the reason Arizona's got this mess on its hands is a result of the fact that for more than 100 years, there has been no due process in immigration proceedings. The federal government has basically said, we don't want to give people due process in immigration proceedings, so we're not going to make them criminal. We're going to make them civil, because that way we don't have to worry about giving people lawyers and advising them of their constitutional rights and giving them a whole bunch of due process protections. So the federal government has made most immigration proceedings civil, and that's now come back to bite Arizona, because that's why Arizona's law ultimately failed. The Supreme Court said, look, the federal government has these civil penalties. You can't turn around and criminalize these things under state law. And, of course, it turns out that being in the United States with an expired immigration status isn't a crime at all. It's just a civil violation under federal immigration law. The majority rejected a theory that some folks had posited to try to get these state laws passed, and this is a mirror image theory, the idea that you can pass a state law that mirrors a federal law and that will make it constitutional. The majority didn't directly say we reject the mirror image theory, but their opinion implies, as Professor Eastman said, that it's the old preemption theory back again, and we're not accepting this new mirror image theory. So that no longer will be a theory that can underlie these state laws, and so the copycat state laws in six states that have had these sort of laws are going to fail. And again, the only provision upheld is the one that doesn't have teeth and is very, very difficult to implement. So I think now we're left with the states have a much more limited role in immigration than people thought might be the case, and the immigration fight now goes back to Congress. The court was pretty clear that although there are serious problems in the United States with immigration, the fault lies with Congress, which has dodged its responsibility to fix these problems. I'd also point out in closing here, before turning things back over to John, that the court was in a little bit of a dilemma here, because the Ninth Circuit had enjoined all four sections of SB 1070 that were at issue. And so if Justice Roberts did not join the other four justices, then the Ninth Circuit's decision would have been upheld. Since Justice Kagan had recused herself, you would have had a 4-4 split on the court. But what that leaves us with is a 5-3 decision saying that three sections of the law are, in fact, unconstitutional. A preliminary injunction stays in place, and the other one just goes back to see if it can be applied in a manner that is constitutional. Thank you. Back to you, John.
Yeah, the one thing before we turn to the questions that we haven't talked about yet is the Department of Justice and the President's argument here that their enforcement discretion itself would preempt the state law enforcement priorities that were different. The court pretty uniformly, this is part of the unanimous decision, rejected that. Or, as Justice Alito noted in his opinion concurring on this point, the United States argument that Section 2B is preempted not by any federal statute or regulation, but simply by the executive's current enforcement policy, is an astounding assertion of federal executive power that the court rightly rejects. And that was the essence of the department's broad challenge here. And so by the majority focusing on preemption doctrines in the intent of Congress, they pretty clearly rejected that claim that executive powers that the executive department's just enforcement decisions and discretion could preempt a state law. If the state laws were consistent with congressional policy, the executive's contrary enforcement decisions would not preempt it. Now, that means that Congress, if it chooses, has some room here to respond to the Supreme Court's decision. And I'll give one example. The failure to carry immigration papers, which is a violation of federal law, and it's a criminal offense under federal law. Arizona made it a criminal defense under state law to make sure that these things were getting enforced, even if the Department of Justice and the executive branch of the national government were not enforcing them. Congress is silent on whether it is intended to preclude state enforcement of that statute. Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, infers that there was preemption, that Congress intended to preempt state efforts in this area by some combination of, as I said, field and obstacle preemption. But Congress could easily say, no, we recognize that the states have a role here. Similarly, with the provisions of Section 5C, where Arizona made it a crime to seek work that for which you were not lawfully allowed to seek, whereas the federal statute imposes criminal sanctions only on the employers. The inference that Justice Kennedy drew was by imposing criminal sanctions only on the employers, Congress intended not to have any criminal sanctions on the employees. But, of course, Congress could have equally intended by that silence to leave the matter of whether to impose criminal sanctions with the states in their normal regulation of the employment relationships within the state. And so it's always hard to divine Congress's meaning from their silence. That's why the court has been backing away from those preemption doctrines. But if the court's misread of Congress's silence, or if Congress believes that the court misread its silence on the prior move, it could easily say the states are authorized to impose or not impose additional penalties in this area as they see fit in their efforts to exercise their police powers to vindicate the concerns, the safety concerns within their states. So there's much at issue here that Congress could take up if it chose, and the president's non-enforcement decisions will not themselves preempt state law. And then there's one final piece of this, and it's rather an extraordinary reference by Justice Scalia in his opinion to events that transpired just last week with the president unilaterally choosing not to enforce parts of the mandatory removal proceedings for people who are here unlawfully unauthorized, and in fact authorizing work permits for them, I think in violation of federal law. That's a very complicated overlap area, but Justice Scalia referenced it. And I think, and I've not confirmed this yet, but my understanding is that the administration yesterday, after the decision came down, revoked all of the existing state cooperation agreements, or 287G agreements, that allowed for greater cooperation between states and federal government in the enforcement of federal immigration law. So that's going to provoke another confrontation, I think, with the states on how we enforce the immigration laws. Really stem the tide of these consequences that Justice Kennedy talked about in his opinion on crime and property rights and environmental concerns and what have you, and particularly in border states like Arizona that are suffering so much of the brunt of this process. And so we're not done with this issue yet. There remains a lot of legal and political wrangling, of course, to try and figure out how to resolve these issues, very severe issues, in a way that protects lawful residents, protects against crime, but also ensures the constitutional rights for everybody that are here in this country.
Terrific. Well, I do want to get to the audience questions, but before we do that, why don't we give Professor Stock a minute or two, if you want to take it, Professor.
Well, I just say very, very briefly that I disagree with John slightly in terms of what he was quoting the dissenting opinions, and it looks clearly that the majority thinks that it's up to Congress to provide the executive with the resources. If Congress fails to provide the executive with the resources necessary, then that's Congress's problem, but it doesn't mean that the states can step in and do things that conflict with federal law. So I don't read it quite as harshly as John does in terms of its claimed disagreement with what the president and the Secretary of Homeland Security are attempting to do in terms of their enforcement priorities. It looks to me like it's a resounding endorsement of the idea that the executive branch needs to work with Congress, and they rule in the immigration field, and the states cannot interfere with that.
Okay. Let's open the floor to audience questions. Let's go to the first question.
Hi, this is Mario Loyola, Texas Public Policy Foundation, and I just wanted to ask the two experts to focus a little bit more on the technical preemption analysis, especially in the discussion of 5C. I'm not an expert on preemption, but I thought that part of the opinion was just terrible. And I mean, if you know, the law, the federal law has a specific preemption provision that says criminal penalties cannot be imposed on employers for illegally hiring undocumented immigrants. But we're going to accept from this provision licensing requirements. So through that loophole, the states have been able to pass E-Verify laws that say if you hire an illegal immigrant, we're gonna revoke your business license, and if you want it back, you need to pay a fine of, you know, X thousands of dollars or whatever it is. And that's worked out very well. Now, on the other side, the federal law doesn't mention state penalty, criminal penalties at all. And from this, Kennedy drew the rather incredible conclusion that even though there's a preemption provision with respect to employers and there's not one with respect to employees, that must mean that Congress intended to preempt all state criminal enforcement against employees illegally seeking employment. And so my question is, first of all, do the two experts agree that this opinion was very thin on analysis, I thought? Do they agree with that part of the holding? And second of all, if the implication of this is, does this ruling have novel implications for other areas of the law, for example, in the environmental context? Are we now, because that would be great news if now we can preempt, California regulations or regulations in New York that go above and beyond the Clean Air Act and impose criminal penalties where federal law doesn't impose them. Can we take this precedent and use it in those other contexts?
I share your views that this part of Justice Kennedy's opinion is weak. And like I said in my opening remarks, I think it bucks the trend in recent years away from using these implied preemption doctrines to strike down state laws, and for all of the reasons you suggest. We know that there was discussion in adopting the 1996 Immigration Act on whether we should have federal criminal sanctions on employees or just employers. They passed them only on employers. And they have an express preemption clause that says states can't do anything civil or criminal except through their licensing laws dealing with employers. Justice Kennedy takes the silence on any criminal sanction on employees to be an intent by Congress to leave no criminal sanctions in place for employees, either federal or state. And, of course, as Justice Alito points out in his dissent on this issue, you can just as easily read that silence to say we don't want a federal crime of this, but because as the Supreme Court recognized in the 1970s decision of Ducanis versus Baica, the employer-employee relationship, is something that's pretty core to the exercise of state sovereignty. We leave it to the states to decide whether they want to take it further or not. And both of those things can be read into that silence from Congress. And it's the problem with the implied preemption doctrine. Now, as to your question on whether this new full embrace of those kind of increasingly discredited implied preemption doctrines can be used in other areas like environmental law, I think this court could easily say, there's something rather unique about naturalization and immigration policy. It really is vested more exclusively in the national government than environmental policy, and therefore we'll put a stronger thumb on the scale of implied preemption doctrines there that we won't apply in other areas of the law. The other example where there's this kind of vesting of exclusive plenary power in Congress, where the rules adopted yesterday might apply, would be in the bankruptcy code, but not in everything else where there's a lot more overlap between state and federal authority. Just a guess, but that would keep the trend against these implied preemption doctrines in place, but for the immigration context and perhaps the bankruptcy context.
Yeah, I would disagree with John in terms of the opinion being thinly supported. I think Justice Kennedy and the majority cited a lot of legislative history. He did so rather quickly, but in fact, during the debates on IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act that was signed by President Reagan back in 1986, there was a tremendous amount of debate about whether to impose criminal penalties on people who wanted to work. And the Congress did determine not to do that, and there were a number of reasons why they did that. Part of the concern had to do with civil rights issues and making it a crime to merely try to work also for philosophical reasons seem to violate some people's sensibilities. You know, just the idea that you would make it a crime for somebody to want to work bothered people. And Congress did make a deliberate decision to say we are not going to punish people for trying to work. We're going to punish them criminally if they use false documents, but we're only going to have civil penalties for working without permission. And those civil penalties may bar them under certain circumstances from getting certain kinds of immigration status, but we're not going to make it a crime simply to work in the United States. Now,
but if Congress came to that, if Congress came to that judgment, then why didn't they put a preemption provision in the law?
Well, I don't think at the time it occurred to anybody that Arizona was going to do something like this. So, you know, that if you go back and look at preemption, Doctor, it doesn't require an express preemption provision. You can have conflict preemption, obstacle preemption, field preemption. And what the court held here was that this is an area of the law that is occupied. The federal government has, you know, they've passed a comprehensive statute that covers this provision. And what Kennedy says is the existence of an express preemption provision does not bar the ordinary working of conflict preemption principles or impose a special burden that would make it more difficult to establish the preemption of laws falling outside the clause. And he quotes another Supreme Court case, the American Honda case. So he's doing, you know, fairly traditional preemption analysis. It may be something that is disfavored now that people don't like, but he's returning to kind of the traditional law school preemption analysis that people studied years ago. I don't think it's as thin as it might appear to be.
Oh, but I guess the question is, if I agree with you that the field and conflict and obstacle preemption were all available back in 1986, and that would have equally applied to the preemption of state law issues dealing with employers as well as employees, and yet Congress saw fit to create an express preemption clause dealing with employers and not an express preemption clause dealing with employees. And that strongly suggests that they intended to make this a matter at the federal level, not criminalized, but not to preempt state efforts to the contrary. And you know, there's legislative history going both ways, which is why the court has backed away from obstacle or field preemption, because when you can read a legislative history and silence on the ultimate question, why we don't have an express preemption clause dealing with employees, when you can read it two ways, the normal presumption against preemption would allow the states to operate in the area, and Congress can easily fix it with an express preemption clause if it so chooses. That's not what happened here, and I think it's that part of the analysis. Yes, it's cited to prior authority, but it's that part of the analysis that is weak, because it just doesn't logically flow given what we know in the court's other areas recently in dealing with those implied preemption contexts.
Well, sir, but you can say your argument doesn't logically flow either. It just depends which side which way you decide to look at it, John. That's the problem. And of course, the preemption argument here, the one that you disfavor, got the majority vote, including Chief Justice Roberts. So that's what we're going to live with now.
Let's go to the next question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. One of the things I found interesting in all the opinions, and especially in that of the dissenting opinion of Scalia, who I would expect would have perhaps ventured further onto the subject, is the constitutional authority for excluding entry by illegal persons, which is not the naturalization clause. It's the law of nations clause. And the Supreme Court doesn't seem to understand the law of nations clause. Perhaps you could explore that further and also suggest ways in which either states could now proceed to do what they can under the least this recent ruling, such as forbidding employment by the state or state agencies of illegal aliens, or that might be accomplished by an act of Congress to clarify the relationship between the federal government and the states in this area.
Okay, well, let me take a stab at the first part of that. Scalia's opinion is quite interesting, and I recommend it to people for reading from interest. He, on page 6 of his opinion, he talks about the fact that immigration isn't in, the power to regulate immigration is not related to the naturalization clause. And I point that out only because a lot of people do point to the naturalization clause in the Constitution as a source of federal authority to regulate immigration. But Scalia says that naturalization clause is not the source of authority. He says, rather, it's an inherent attribute of sovereignty. And he says, no less for the United States than for the states. He also mentions the clause relating to migration or importation of persons as being a possible source of authority. And this is rather interesting. The problem, of course, is that we've had a couple hundred years of Supreme Court jurisprudence that has given the federal government plenary power over immigration and not given the states plenary power. John, did you want to add?
Yeah, so I mean, there is, I think, a little bit more nuance to Justice Scalia's opinion. It's not one that deprives the federal government of power over immigration, but it's one that recognizes that the states also have a power over immigration into their own states. The Privileges and Immunities Clause doesn't let them throw up any barriers to citizens from other states or lawful residents. But the question of whether they can prevent people from coming into their borders who are not authorized to be here at all is one that Justice Scalia raised. And if it's a power tied to naturalization clause, which is exclusively given to Congress, then that exclusivity necessarily precludes the states from exercising the parallel power. But if it's as Justice Scalia argues, a power that's inherent in sovereignty, the sovereignty on these questions is divided between the federal and state governments. Arizona can't determine who crosses the border with Mexico in a way contrary to congressional policy, but that's different than saying who can cross the border from other states and what they do within Arizona while they're there. And if they're unlawfully here in the first place, Arizona helping to give effect to those provisions would not buck this notion of sovereignty. Like Margaret said, though, it's a position that was rejected by the majority of the court here, and the implications from the number of prior Supreme Court decisions that equated naturalization authority with immigration authority pretty strongly suggests that the court had accepted a different proposition for where the source of immigration power was.
However, shouldn't we not now be pushing for a revival of the Law of Nations Clause for this purpose? Because historically, illegal entry was a violation of the Law of Nations.
Yes, and illegal entry is a violation of the positive law here too. The big fight over here is, you know, do the states have any parallel ability to enforce those violations, whether of the positive law or the Law of Nations? And I think Justice Scalia's point on this is very well made as well, although not persuasively enough to prevail with the majority of the court. And that is, you know, local law enforcement have the ability to, you know, sue out arrest warrants for violations of federal laws all the time in all sorts of areas. The fact that they can't do so here now is really a new twist on some very old, longstanding rules. It's very clear that local law enforcement can't be compelled to be the enforcers of federal law, though we have, you know, 10th Amendment anti-commandeering principles that play out there. But the notion that they can't assist if their own elected officials deem it worth their policy priorities to do so, in the absence of an express prohibition from Congress to the contrary, really does change the default rule and the normal presumption against preemption of state efforts that has heretofore prevailed. And I think that's what Justice Alito and Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia are most strongly challenging to the majority's opinion. You really haven't just bucked the trend against these implied preemption doctrines, but you've completely flipped the switch on the presumption against preemption that has heretofore existed.
Yeah, there's a complication that I think you wouldn't appreciate if you didn't do immigration law, but that's that whenever a state charges somebody with a crime, it affects their eligibility for benefits under federal immigration law. So, for example, in the scheme that was announced last Friday by Secretary Napolitano, an immigrant who has three misdemeanor convictions of any kind would be precluded from relief. So the state of Arizona, if it had been allowed to carry out this SB 1070 criminal provisions would be able to disrupt this federal scheme simply by charging people repeatedly with being unlawfully present in the United States. So I think that part of that played into it, although it's not explicitly stated in the majority opinion, but they're clearly aware, and they appear to applaud what the federal government is doing to try to lessen the problem with regard to the issue of priorities and resources. So I think that plays into it. I'm not sure where the law of nations argument gets you as far as state authority goes. It seems that they'll still fall back on the argument that the federal government is primary and should be exercising that. Right.
Yeah. Although Arizona still has one of the provisions that have been upheld, the state law crime for transporting or harboring illegal immigrants. And you know, so that means at the you've run a red light or a stop sign, stop. And then we have reasonable suspicion to think that you are here unlawfully. I can then impose criminal sanctions under the state law because you're transporting yourself or the other people in your car if they are here illegally. And that's a separate state law crime. And then that would trigger ineligibility for the new waiver of removal or amnesty, depending on how you want to call it, that was announced last week by the president and the secretary.
Right, but that one was already, they had already said you couldn't get benefits if you had violated that one. So it's kind of moot, but they're not letting anybody get benefits who had a serious immigrant smuggling conviction.
Well, but the Arizona statute is much broader than just the smuggling. It's anybody, any transportation or harboring
right.
of an unauthorized alien.
Ineligible under the federal policy. You would be ineligible for the benefits that they laid out.
And let's go to our next question.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Maine. I'm not an attorney, so I have two naive questions. Why is it not possible to seek a mandamus against the president to enforce the immigration laws passed by Congress? And also, would it be possible to challenge state and local sanctuary laws and policies?
Well, on the first question, the president has a great deal of prosecutorial discretion on when and when not to enforce the laws. Normally, that's applied on a case-by-case basis. There's some question whether we can just globally choose not to enforce whole areas of the law, and I think that issue is now presented front and center because of the president's decisions last week. And there are also some various technical provisions in the immigration code that I think the president's authorization here is violating. I think there are specific paths for suspension of removal proceedings with specific criteria, and he has ignored those criteria and gone further and kind of globally waived or suspended removal proceedings from people who are not eligible for them under either the paths that are authorized by statute. So I do think there are some issues that are presented here. Part of the problem is going to be who has the legal standing to challenge the president's decision not to enforce. That's a very complicated question, and it's hard to see immediately a way through to that. And I'm sorry, the second part of the question was?
Would it be possible now to challenge state and local sanctuary policies as interfering with the federal government?
Well, that too is a bit of a complicated question. Yet, certainly in Arizona, parts of the Arizona statute that were upheld in the lower courts and therefore not presented to the Supreme Court were the prohibitions of the anti-sanctuary city efforts. There's a ban on any local government limiting the enforcement of cooperation with federal law enforcement on immigration policy and allowing citizen suits to go forward for violations of those provisions. That's a pretty hefty provision that remains on the books in Arizona. More complicated, it seems to me, is whether the implied preemption rationale adopted by Justice Kennedy in this case for the majority of the court would mean that the states, Arizona couldn't supplement immigration policy. It would seem to apply equally or even more so to state efforts to undermine federal immigration policy, which is what the sanctuary movement is trying to do. The reason I say it gets complicated is there's a line there that doctrine can't cross, which is to compel state officers to become effectively federal law enforcement agents. We can't commandeer them to do that. But to the extent the sanctuary city efforts are falling short of that, that are deliberately thwarting federal enforcement policies, I think under the rationales offered by Justice Kennedy, those policies, those sanctuary city policies, might be constitutionally suspect as well.
Yeah, I should cut in here and just say that I disagree that what the president is doing is unlawful. In fact, President Reagan did similar things. It was during the Reagan administration that deferred action became a way for people to get work permits. The regulations were adopted during the Reagan administration, and there have been a number of memos over the years that are categorical that give temporary immigration status to foreigners unlawfully in the country. One of the most famous ones is the Cuban memo, which has existed for several decades now, which says that if you're a Cuban found in the United States and you don't have permission to be here, the government will give you a work permit, and they will give you a document saying you're allowed to be here, and then 1 year later you can apply for a green card. That's been going on for decades and decades. So it's not the case that what the president's doing is anything new. This all started under the Reagan administration.
Yeah, but we have to explore that a bit more because the Cuba exemption is specifically authorized by the statutes.
No, it's not. The parole of Cubans is not authorized by the statute. The Congress passed a statute that said Cubans could adjust, but they can't adjust unless they are put in the parole status, and so therefore the memo was created to put them in the parole status that lets them take advantage of the law that otherwise they wouldn't be able to take advantage of. So you could argue, well, that's the executive circumventing the law because Congress meant for all the Cubans to stay home and apply back home, and the president circumventing the law by letting the ones who entered unlawfully adjust status here. That would be the argument that you'd make if you were making the same argument people are making against President Obama. But the fact is the executive's been exercising these kind of authorities for decades, and it's unusual in that this is a very large number of people, but the underlying legal authority has existed for a long time, and it's not a situation of lawlessness going on here. It's prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah, I have to dispute that because that may have been true in the 1980s. It's not true after the 1996 Act, which gives two paths to do these suspensions. And the one is if somebody has been lawfully present and then overstayed, the president can do this if there is a family necessity of extreme circumstances.
No, John, that's wrong. And there's no law that says what you just said.
I'm looking at Section 213 of the 1996 IRCA statute right now, and it specifically says that. And then the president's ability to give those things is limited to 4,000 per year, the suspension of removals.
You're talking about cancellation of removal for non-lawful permanent residents. Those are people that have put into proceedings and are trying to get a green card. President Obama's not giving anybody a green card. He's doing something that's outside the immigration court proceedings. What you're talking about is a provisional law that lets an immigration judge grant a certain number of green cards per year to people that are in immigration court.
One other question?
Go ahead. Yeah, Margaret and I can debate the technicalities of that later. Let's go to your next question.
Okay, there's probably always a need for some amount of discretion, and a lot of the laws passed that things are mandatory eliminate that, which is not necessarily a good idea, but I can understand the reason for it. But when does the blatant and open discretion seemingly applied in an arbitrary and capricious way, particularly right now with this president, when does that make a virtual fiction of the rule of law?
Well, you know, I think it does. You know, discretion not to enforce in a particular case is one thing, but wholesale decision not to enforce an entire aspect of the law is essentially giving the president a post-signature veto that he is unilaterally
altering
the law.
You have been muted.
And it's a huge problem. It seems to me, and, you know, put the shoe on the other foot. Suppose the Supreme Court on Thursday upholds the health care bill, and Governor Romney is elected in November on a pledge that he will repeal it, and he can't get it through Congress, and so he just unilaterally says these things shall not be enforced and gives waivers to everybody. I mean, you know, there would be a hue and cry rising from every corner of the country that exceeds the president's power. And yet it seems to me that that's exactly what the president did last week, in just wholesale And by the way, the president himself acknowledged this. 2 years ago, when he was pushing for this very policy that he adopted by fiat last week, he said that he had no constitutional authority to do that, that was within the prerogative of Congress. And only after he failed to get it through to Congress does he all of a sudden find the constitutional authority to do the very thing that he said he had no constitutional authority to do. It seems to me that the Article 2 provision to take care that the laws be faithfully executed means that you can't just wholesale decide not to execute them.
Well, I think he said that a couple of years ago, but he was technically wrong. I mean, I heard him say that at the time, and I thought he doesn't understand the history. He doesn't realize that President Reagan did similar things, and there's nothing unconstitutional about it. It's an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. It's allowed in the law, and it's longstanding. There's regulations that have gone through APA approval for this sort of thing. Congress, if they didn't like it, could pass a law and say, we don't like it. But frankly, what Congress does all the time is they, in meritorious cases, they write to the president and they demand that the president do these for individual cases. And he gets letters, thousands of letters every day from people asking for help on behalf of their constituents, and they don't want this person deported and they don't want that person deported, and could you please give this person deferred action? And, you know, this goes on. And I think the underlying problem here is, frankly, that Congress has not done its job. They have created a statute that is a mess. The legal immigration system is dysfunctional. It's a complete mess. Carrying it out, enforcing it, it has contrary objectives within it that create problems for the federal government all the time. And until Congress tackles comprehensive immigration reform and they create a statute that makes sense, we have a mess on our hands. And it's a lot like what President Reagan said we had back in the 1980s with the tax system, where the tax system was being violated routinely because it didn't make any sense. People didn't understand it. President Reagan got through comprehensive tax reform. We need something like that, comprehensive immigration reform, to make our legal immigration system make sense. And then a lot of these problems will go away.
Let's go to the next question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. You didn't really answer the second part of my previous question about what measures remain that might be taken, first by states, and secondly, what might a model immigration, federal immigration bill look like. For states, perhaps they could make it illegal for state agencies or local governments to hire illegal aliens or to allow anyone who receives state funds to do so.
Right. We didn't tackle that one, but I should mention that the Whiting case was decided by the Supreme Court, and that was a case that dealt with more of these employment-type issues. And so in this particular case, what they were dealing with was only the issue about the criminality of somebody seeking work. But you might want to take a look at the Supreme Court's case in Chamber of Commerce of the United States v. Whiting. This was a case in which the Supreme Court said that the Legal Arizona Workers Act, which provided for the suspension and revocation of the business license of Arizona employers and knowingly or intentionally employ unauthorized aliens, is not preempted. So we do have to remember that Arizona won another case previously relating to employment issues, and this was a preemption case that they won. So a state that's seeking to regulate employment could certainly look at that statute and attempt to copy it and presumably would be upheld.
Yeah, that's right. I agree with that. And also, look, because these were implied preemption rulings by Justice Kennedy, Congress could say, no, the implication you drew was wrong, or even if it was right, we no longer agree with it. It's a federal law crime to fail to carry the immigration papers mandated by federal law. Because the executive is not enforcing that, or because we can't give him enough resources to fully enforce it, we explicitly authorize the states to do so, to create their own state law crimes. That would make Arizona's statute perfectly valid if Congress were to weigh in, rebutting the implication that Justice Kennedy drew from their silence on that issue. So there are a number of things that Congress can do to alter the presumptions here the other direction again, if it so chooses.
Right, and Congress could also make it a federal crime to do these things, and they have held hearings on that, but they've concluded they don't want to spend the money, because if they make it a federal crime, then they have to give all these people attorneys, and they have to give them due process rights, and so forth and so on. And that is one of the key reasons why none of this stuff is criminalized federally. Too expensive.
Can either of you suggest a model
immigration statute that somebody has proposed?
Well, there have been a number of them over the years. Certainly the one that was drawing bipartisan support a few years ago, it had some problems at the end, but the original one that was a bipartisan Senate proposal made sense. And it had a whole bunch of provisions in it. It had provisions to legalize people so that then we wouldn't have this problem. They would have to come forward and get fingerprinted and pay fines and pay back taxes and pay big penalties to the federal government. The federal government was going to make a lot of money off the deal. It had a guest worker program in it. It also had increased enforcement, more border patrol agents. So it was a comprehensive package, but it didn't pass.
But would it have rationalized the defects that you have been identifying?
Yes. The immigration code today is arbitrary, capricious, and irrational, if you look at it in toto. It doesn't make any sense. And this is one of the reasons why immigration law is so difficult and complicated, because the law, every year Congress tinkers with it. They add something. Something conflicts with something else, and hardly anybody understands it. There's a famous quote from the immigration spokesperson in the Washington Post one time who said, immigration law is a mystery and a mastery of obfuscation. And that's absolutely accurate. It's just not possible unless you're an expert in the field to understand it all. Very few people do. So it creates a dysfunctional mess. And one of the reasons we have so much illegal immigration is because people cannot get legal. There are not provisions under the law for them to enter legally and do the things that normal people want to do, have families, work, so forth and so on. So we have a tremendous amount of illegality. We also punish people for leaving if they've been here illegally. And everyone thinks that is a bizarre provision of the law. If you're here in an unlawful fashion and you leave, you get punished. But if you stay, you don't get punished. That doesn't make any sense, but that's in the law. And that was part of the 1996 law that John was mentioning. So we have a lot of dysfunction in the law, and if they would fix all that, much happiness would be restored to the Republic, and probably Arizona would be a lot happier, and we wouldn't need a lot of this state regulation of immigration.
But part of the problem—
Can you cite a source for this model legislation?
Well, I would go back to the bipartisan bill that McCain-Kennedy that was introduced in the Senate way back when, the original version, not the final version, because the final version had been gutted and wasn't ever going to go into effect.
Is there a website or something where this can be found?
Sure. Thomas.gov.
Congressional website. LOC.gov, I think.
LOC. Library of Congress.thomas.gov, the congressional website.
But look, the global problem here is and was then and remains, how do you adjust the status of people who are currently unlawfully present in the United States to kind of put all of the complications behind us without on a going forward basis creating an even greater incentive for a new round of illegal immigration? That was tried in the 1986 bill with an initial amnesty of a couple million people, and all that did was create a new magnet for 5 to 10 times that amount of illegal immigration that has occurred subsequently. And that remains the central problem on how to fix the current immigration complications without creating a new round and new incentive for violating whatever the new law will be and at a magnitude much greater than even we have currently. And that's been the bottleneck and the holdup, and we have not figured out how to address that question yet.
Well, I think the problem in 86 was that they didn't create a pathway for people to come lawfully. So they gave a limited remedy to a certain group of people that were in the country at one point in time, but then didn't fix the fact that we have had a booming economy, we have a lot of jobs, people come here for the jobs, and they're going to continue to come for the jobs until such time as there are no jobs and they stop coming. And we have learned what the fix is for illegal immigration. It's tank your economy. Illegal immigration has dropped substantially. When our economy went south, so did the illegal immigration. That's not a practical solution. So the legal solution would be to create a way for future flows of people to come lawfully if they have a lawful reason for coming here. And we haven't fixed that problem. And I think it's well recognized by partisan commissions. I was on a commission with Jeb Bush and Mac McClarty, and they concluded that the legal immigration system is a mess that needs to be fixed a couple of years ago. But nobody in Congress will come up with a solution. So the Supreme Court in Arizona v. United States has now pointed back to Congress and said, you all need to fix this. The states aren't going to be allowed to do this.
Okay. Well, thank you both. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Professor Margaret Stock and Professor John Eastman for joining us today. Also, thank you to our audience. I invite you again to join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. for our call on judicial activism. And let me invite you also to check the Teleforum website page on the Federalist Society's website for future additional calls. But until tomorrow at 2 p.m., we're adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.